bring the House Public Safety Policy Committee and Finance Committee to order and start out with the roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Yeah.
Johnson. Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel. Leidiger. Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran. Nornis.
Here.
Slocum. Smith.
All right, members, we have a quorum, so we'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes from April 13th. What do you want to move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, after extensive review, I move the minutes from April 13th.
Okay. Representative Woodard moves the minutes of April 13th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none. Yes, go ahead.
Representative Woodard, did you do background checks on some of these things?
Yeah.
Representative, no, and I don't think any of us would want us to.
Okay, no additions or corrections. All in favor of approval of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carried. Members, we're going to get right into our agenda today. The first bill, House File 977, and this bill is authored and co-authored between Representative Ward and myself. And Representative Ward, if you'd approach the table, Representative Ward is going to do the testifying for the bill today. I'd like to handle it as the Representative Ward will start out. I'll move House File 977 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Representative Ward will do the introduction, and then I would follow up when he gets all done and then take questions if that's all right with the committee. So Representative Ward, your bill is moved. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cornish and members. Truly is a blessing for me to be in front of you twice this week. So thank you for that opportunity. Members, Chair Cornish is the chief on this bill, and I'm the co on this bill, and we've teamed together to bring this very small bill to you, which has very, very big implications to every citizen in the state of Minnesota regarding public safety, no matter where you live in the state. You know, allow me to please paint a picture of what this bill does for you in your own minds. Kind of a visual that all of us, I think, can relate to. So let me ask you this by a show of hands. How many of you have either stayed in a hospital or had a family member stay in a hospital? Some of you have never been in a hospital or stayed in a hospital? Well, most of you have. Most of you have. So, members, let me tell you, if you've been in a hospital or stayed in a hospital, had a family member there, you know, hospitals, you know, are multi-floored facilities. Let's say this hospital has 9 floors. On each floor, there's a nursing station. Each nursing station, as you know, is critical to that floor. I just spent some time recently in a hospital for a time period, and I know that the importance of each nursing station on each floor is critical. And if you were a patient or your family member was a patient, you know that when you or your family member needed that service, you expected that nursing station to reply and respond and provide that service immediately, you know, if not sooner. And even sometimes, members, those I heard as I was in the hospital for that period of 2 weeks recently, I heard that phrase code blue a number of times. And code blue simply means that somebody's life is at stake here. And the quicker that we respond, the quicker that life may be saved. So, members, let's say that each of those 9 nursing stations on that 9-story hospital was reduced down to 1 nursing station in that hospital. Can you visualize that? 1 nursing station. And it matters where that nursing station is placed on those 9 floors as to the rapid response you're going to get or the maybe even the quality of service that you're going to get, as nurses need to go between the 2 floors. So let me also indicate this, members. Part of what you're going to hear today from maybe the Minnesota State Patrol is that we can consolidate these, and this is what this bill is about, consolidating our 9 dispatching units in the state of Minnesota, in greater Minnesota or in real Minnesota, down to 2. And they're going to say we can do that by using technology. Let me go back to my hospital vision, members. Before we had elevators, we had what are called stairs. Remember those? And we know those here too well because many of us have waited at an elevator or been late to a committee meeting, so we've chosen to then take the stairs. Okay? But let's just say that the elevator is our technology. You know, our technology, as the Minnesota State Patrol is going to say, that we have this technology that will allow us to do this consolidation. Let's say that in that hospital, and we have those elevators that is a symbol of our technology. Let's say that the elevator is stalled. Or let's say that it's on the first floor and you're on the ninth. Or let's say that it is even maybe broken down. Members, that elevator is critical to, again, the response time, the quality of service that you may receive, just like the technology that the Minnesota State Patrol is going to say that we can use to do this consolidation of the dispatching units. Members, sometimes that technology doesn't work. Sometimes those elevators don't work. You know, members, also in our state constitution, of which I brought with me this morning, in Article 1 and in Section 1, right in the very first part, it says, Section 1, Object of Government. Government is instituted for the security, benefit, and protection of the people. And members, I solicit to you that what the Minnesota State Patrol is planning here is not in the best interest of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Matter of fact, I personally believe, and Representative Cornish personally believes, that it is going to cause some significant public safety problems and issues for our citizens in the state of Minnesota. So, members, I've got a handout that I would like to give to you, and I want the pages to hand out. And that, members, the handout is a letter explaining what is going on here. And in this letter, there's also two websites. And the second website, I ask you to, not in committee today, because I want you to listen to me. I hesitate giving these out now because as a former teacher, I know that you're going to start looking at these. I want you to listen to me. Don't start looking at these, but I'm going to give them to you now because I need them as a reference point. The second website is a reference point for you to look at later. And then this is a map, members, of the state of Minnesota and where the nine current, actually there's 10 dispatching centers in the state of Minnesota, nine of them in greater or real Minnesota, and one of them in the metro. And this indicates where the dispatching units currently are, and they are identified by an upturn arrow. You'll see that as I continue with my testimony. So, members, the Minnesota State Patrol is planning to consolidate the consolidation of its public safety answering points, called the PSAPs, reduce the number in greater Minnesota from 9 to 2. This costly project will result in the closure of Transportation Operational Control Centers, or TOCCs, in Brainerd, Detroit Lakes, Mankato, Marshall, St. Cloud, Thief River Falls, and Virginia, while attempting to relocate these emergency dispatch capabilities and communication staff to two centers in Duluth and Rochester. So the nine units are going from many outstate areas, many outstate cities, down to two, Duluth and Rochester. Now, if you're in Duluth and Rochester, and that nursing station is right on the same floor that you're on, you're not concerned about that. But if that nursing station in Brainerd is on the third floor and I'm on the ninth floor, I'm concerned about that. So I hope you get that, members. I know you do. Let me just continue. These are unrealistic expectations and reflect a lack of understanding of the mission and broad operation requirements of Greater Minnesota Multi-Agency Control Centers. Minnesota State Patrol will argue that today's technology will allow us to dispatch from anywhere. This may be true, members, for telemarketers or IT support for PC repair, but we are responsible for delivering immediate emergency response, saving minutes, and saving lives. Potentially life-threatening emergencies. Struggling to determine a caller's location from hundreds of miles away when the caller dispatcher are not familiar with local geography, resources, or commonly used landmarks or names will delay emergency response to the incident. Consolidation relies heavily on technology, such as the GPS and the 91 NILI data, to plot a caller's exact location on the map, as you can see, members. The reality is this technology, where available, members, it's not available in every part of every corner of the state. Remember that as well. Isn't fail-safe and relies on a specific process of correctly transferring 911 calls from each of our state's county PSAP, public safety answering points, operators. Often these 911 calls are incorrectly transferred to administration lines or not transferred at all. In greater rural Minnesota, a significant number of our incoming calls transfers are received without GPS or NILI location data at all. The Minnesota State Patrol leadership is viewing the PSAP consolidation from a 7-county metro area perspective. While there is no question that the consolidation communication center model can succeed when effectively applied to multiple local and county agencies in close geographical proximity, this isn't the case with 9 geographically different centers that reside in diverse regions of our state. And members, there's a thing called situational awareness in law enforcement. And those that are in law enforcement recognize the fact that situational awareness means that's the human element. And I can read you stories about how situational awareness has played a key factor in helping response rapidly and critically to those in need. And I'm not going to take the time to read those stories, but unless you want me to, but I can give you numbers of verified stories on situational awareness and how the human element, you know, made a difference rather than the computer element. You know, these existing control centers are much more than just calling in centers or call processing centers. 10 years ago, members, in 2001, the state of Minnesota spent $30 million consolidating our control centers and brought on not only the Minnesota State Patrol, but the Department of Transportation and DNR. So these calling centers are facilitating calls for the State Patrol, for the Department of Transportation, and for the DNR. Whether it be a DNR violation, whether it be a winter storm, and all of a sudden we've got to call out the plows. These control centers, TOCCs, are critical in a rapid response, quick response to all the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Members, this, you know, I've been working on this for 2 years because a couple of my constituents are greatly impacted, like many of yours are also, I know, greatly impacted, job-wise, family-wise. And, you know, it's critical in the state of Minnesota that we try to preserve as many jobs as we can, even though we also know that we have to reform and redesign and cut. We know that. But we need to do it from a perspective that is wise and smart and fiscally responsible and also protects those values and principles that we hold so dearly to our citizens of the state of Minnesota. And public safety is one of those. I've asked over and over again, what is the cost savings to this? I asked Colonel Donaski. I asked Commissioner Campion, what's the cost savings? And nobody can tell me or anybody else what the projected cost savings are. Members, I say to you, if we don't know, it's not broken. We don't need to fix it. But our public safety of our citizens is at hand here. Members, I also have asked, what is it going to cost to update? Now, the metro station, you know, currently has all the updated technology that we need to do this. But Duluth and Rochester don't. So how are we? What is it going to cost for us to consolidate and bring those two centers into compliance, into what we need to make sure the public safety of our citizens is protected? Is protected. And I've been given estimates of anywhere up to two to $10 million in the total project to finish this project. Members, you know, we don't have the revenue to do that. We don't have the revenue to do that. Bottom line. So let's make sure that we're not hurting our citizens by going forward with projects that are costly and, in my opinion, ineffective and put the risk of our citizens at hand. Members, I could go on and on and on because I've been working on this for 2 years, and I'm thankful that Representative Cornish has and I have combined together to work on this effort. But I just ask you to please visualize my example at the start of going to one nursing station in a 9-story hospital. I use a 9-story hospital for a reason, if you didn't figure that out. Versus what we currently have, the system that we have. And members, remember, in 2001, the 9 consolidated TOCC units that cost $30 million at that time to the state of Minnesota, $30 million and was researched out and studied, you know, is a system that is currently working and functioning wonderful. So, members, I'll stop for now. I would like to go on, but I'm going to stop for now. And Representative Cornish, I think, has something to add. And he and I will both stand for questions.
Representative Ward, do you have to leave yet? You said that 10:30 might have to skip out.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to stay right to the end of this.
Okay. Representative Gauthier, could you wait until I get done with my...
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Here's the crux to the issue, members. About 2000, they come out with this book, the State Patrol, Department of Public Safety, Department of Transportation Deployment Initiative. And I'll check the figures to make sure we're right, but in this huge book here is how we got to the dispatch centers that we currently have all over the state. Whether it was $30 million, it was quite a bit of money. And in this booklet, it talks about the reasons that they were going out and that it was important to get out into greater Minnesota, and it was important for partnership, and it would be meet the qualifications for inoperability in the different radio systems. And so glowing things were said about establishing in greater Minnesota and the communication that would result in the partnerships. To give you an idea, in a couple of our... The unfortunate thing about this is that we didn't get any dispatchers to testify today because of the intimidation by management. First of all, management sent out a script to all the captains basically saying that if you get questions about the PSAP consolidation, this is what you'll say. That's undeniable. That happened. Yesterday, the dispatchers, a couple of them, reported that somebody was checking to see if any of them were taking a day off to come down here and testify. And a message was sent out that no state resources would be spent to defend this bill. And thirdly, it was sent out another one saying that if the dispatchers came down to testify, how was it being paid for? Was overtime being used? The dispatchers are basically afraid to testify because of the intimidation. And I would be asking my committee administrator here to send a letter to the patrol to please ask them not to check emails, not to check time cards, and respect the ability of their employees to speak. A couple of years ago, we had this debate in the floor as one of the DFL members had a bill saying that we should be allowed free and easy access and that discipline should not result out of an employee that wanted to talk to us about something that the employee thought was good for the state. So that was very disappointing. I hope that isn't going to happen. And anybody that's talked to us so far, I hope, won't be disciplined or somehow be held back from a promotion. The dispatch centers... I can find no reason, really, after reading this and what it was supposed to do to the current state where we've got them, I can't find any basic good reason why they should be consolidated other than just for the sake of consolidation. It seems to diminish the capability to do things efficiently. And just to give you a little bit of an inside, the things that you lose, one MnDOT director of MnDOT in one of the districts, he didn't even want to testify or say anything because of he felt, you know, it shouldn't be his place. But MnDOT has told these people that this is a bad idea, this consolidation. The partnership that they were used to having, the MnDOT director or district engineer coming into the office, the conversations, maybe a background check or a check on the weather or different things that they did together in all of these centers is lost. Now instead of having one in my area, in Mankato, it's going to be in Rochester. And the dispatcher, his situational awareness of what's going on out there, like saying to somebody, well, you know, go out to the sheep ranch and take a right. Now, the officer and the dispatcher, because he or she knows that area, can do that. But that familiarity is lost. And big deal, you've got this fancy GPS and graphics in Rochester showing a little GPS where the vehicle is going. You can say, turn right. But you just lose something in the communication. And so, but I want to make it clear also that we're not trying to pick a bone with the patrol, and we have a high respect for the state patrol and its officers all the way up through the chain of command, but we just think that this is a bad decision that wasn't needed, and it was done for consolidation's sake. And whether it was Governor Pawlenty or the past administration that came up with this idea is really of no concern either. I just would like... It's my plan to hopefully pass this out of committee today, send it to transportation, where I think probably a more in-depth discussion will be held. But in that, and then the dispatchers, the state patrol has told me that they have a problem nowadays in covering shifts of overtime. But the problem isn't really the reason that they've made this problem is this threat of this consolidation. The dispatchers tell me they've lost almost a dozen people in direct relation to the threat of this consolidation taking place, wondering what would happen to their career. And so rather than worry, they put out feelers for other jobs, and they've lost some. And yes, now they're trying to plug the holes with overtime. So anyway, you've heard from Representative Ward and myself. We can ask questions if you would like, and then go to see if there's any opposition to the bill. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to Mr. Deeble. On line 1-6, where it says, may not close or consolidate, would shall not be a stronger language there? Because may not might mean they may. You're the lawyer.
Mr. Deeble, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Gauthier, I don't have a strong opinion on that. I think that's a prerogative of the legislature as to what kind of statement you want to send to the State Patrol.
Well, then I'll leave it up to the author. And then, Mr. Chair, one question for Representative Ward.
Representative Gauthier.
Representative Ward, I noticed you said real Minnesota, and I'm wondering if we have any legislation defining that for greater Minnesota, because I'd like to sign on.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gauthier, not yet.
Okay. Okay, would you offer that as an amendment? The made a
shell? I think shell is stronger if you consider it friendly. I would like to do that.
If it's okay with the members of the committee, oral amendment is offered by Representative Gauthier on line 1.6 of the House File 977 to change the may to shall. You've heard the amendment. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Apparently, Representative Gauthier has not yet run afoul of Representative Kahn.
Yeah.
He would like to alter his amendment to say, instead of shall, must.
Must not. That's fine.
That sounds right. We'll incorporate that.
You're right. I'm not an English major.
Amendment to the amendment is must not instead of may. Must instead of may on line 1.6. We've heard the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Any more questions? If not, is there any opposition to the bill today? Colonel, come on down. Colonel Donansky is a respected friend of mine and a leader of the State Patrol. Colonel Donansky, before you start, if you could just answer a couple of comments on the memos that were sent out. I'd like to get your assurance that the dispatchers have okay to talk to us without fear of retribution. Would you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Mark Donansky, Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. Mr. Chair, frankly, sir, I would have hoped that there would have been radio communications officers here to address their side of the story on this. To your point about inquiring whether or not dispatchers had taken time off to come down here today, indeed, I did ask that of the commanders. And the reason I asked that was if they did come down, which they were certainly welcome to do, if most of the greater Minnesota people would have taken time to come off down here, the backfill would have been with mandatory overtime, which goes to the point that we were going to make, that there's a lot of overtime that's being spent by the citizens of the state of Minnesota, that if a dispatcher did want to come down here, the backfill would have had been paid by overtime.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Colonel. If you go ahead with your testimony today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, as I mentioned, I am Mark Donansky, Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol, and I really do want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss and clarify issues surrounding the consolidation of the State Patrol's 10 911 dispatch centers, as Representative Ward mentioned, commonly referred to as PSAPs. And you'll hear the word PSAP a lot. In addition to Representative Cornish and Representative Ward's bill, I also understand that I know you passed around a letter that a number of legislators may have been received communications, including that letter, regarding this project. I'm hopeful that I can respond to any questions and concerns that you or colleagues might have. I want to start by saying that truly our organization values and appreciates the work of our communication specialists. In fact, and I truly mean this coincidentally because we didn't know that this hearing was going to be held today, we're having a press release and a press conference today highlighting the work that our dispatchers do in assisting our organization in getting drunk drivers off of our roads. Having said that, I also clearly understand and appreciate the concerns of the 43 employees, the 43 radio communication officers that would be affected and potentially have to relocate under our PSAP consolidation project. We really do believe that the Minnesota State Patrol has acted in accordance with the directions of the legislature and the governor in the development and implementation of our PSAP consolidation plan. As was mentioned, perhaps in 2003, the legislature ordered that a study be conducted and recommendations be made regarding all the PSAPs in the state and consolidation feasibility. In that resulting 172-page document, a large number of consolidation issues were discussed. Among those recommendations was, in that specific recommendation was, that the Minnesota State Patrol explore and consider consolidation of its 10 PSAPs. In 2008, the Minnesota State Patrol received a grant and contracted with the firm of Short, Elliott & Henderson, commonly referred to as SEH, to conduct a comprehensive study of our PSAPs and to make recommendations. In 2009, Governor Pawlenty issued an executive order forming a group to develop a comprehensive strategy regarding the consolidation of all the PSAPs in the state of Minnesota. The State Patrol PSAP report that was done by SEH was supported by the recommendations of Governor Pawlenty's PSAP study group. In 2004 legislative report indicated that consolidation of PSAPs provides for a number of efficiencies. However, not always immediate cost savings. While cost savings was a factor in our study, our primary interest was to see if we could be more efficient in a different configuration and, moreover, provide a better work environment for our communication specialists. Based on the current number of MSP radio communication officers, all of our greater Minnesota PSAPs, with the exception of the one in the metropolitan area, are significantly understaffed. And that's based on the recommendation of that legislative report that was issued in 2004. In fact, the Minnesota State Patrol would have to hire and employ an additional 34 individuals to adequately staff the 9 greater Minnesota centers. Conversely, the current level of staffing would be more than adequate to accommodate the workload at 3 consolidated centers. Keep in mind that in most of the greater Minnesota PSAPs, there's typically one dispatcher on duty at any given time. They're required to take breaks at their radio console. They're required to eat lunch at the radio console, and when they need to go to the restroom, they need to take a portable radio with them and answer the phone, which is attached to the wall next to them. Moreover, when someone gets sick or somebody is out on an extended period of time, there's mandatory overtime. If a dispatcher works all night and the day shift dispatcher calls in sick, they are held over mandatory. Last year, the Minnesota State Patrol spent $43,000 in non-holiday-related overtime for our communication specialists. And while I stated we did not enter into the project with the expectation of cost savings, the SEH report does indicate that consolidation to 3 centers for the Minnesota State Patrol has a potential to save approximately $1 million annually. I wish I could say that we are on the cutting edge of consolidation. However, a number of other state police agencies have also done so. Pennsylvania, Colorado, Iowa, Massachusetts, Idaho, Wisconsin, Indiana, and the province of Ontario have all consolidated their PSAPs. The Wyoming and North Dakota Highway Patrols each dispatch from a single PSAP in their respective states. And as a matter of fact, I'm glad Representative Ward brought up medical issues. Our friends in the first responder private sector have also found consolidation to be a more effective means of communication. North Memorial Ambulance Service dispatches its approximately 800 employees, 150 ambulances, and several helicopters across the state of Minnesota from a single dispatch center in Brooklyn Center, with the exception of a few areas that are still dispatched under a VHF system. Once their system completely turns over to 800, they will be dispatching the entire state of Minnesota out of one center. Mayo, which is also Gold Cross Ambulance, dispatches their fleet of ambulances and helicopters to portions of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and South Dakota from a single point in Rochester. For many reasons, we believe that consolidation is the correct course for the Minnesota State Patrol and the public we serve, regardless of the economic environment. However, because of the economic environment now, more so than ever. I do know that there's a letter that was passed around with a lot of comments, a lot of statements on there. I'm more than willing to answer some of those. Some that the Representative Ward and the chair brought up, I thought I would talk about first. Some issue was given to the $30 million for consolidation back in, I believe it was 2001. $30 million was spent on a large program that talked about transportation, including the Minnesota State Patrol. In fact, approximately $12 million of that money, which was a federal grant, went directly towards MnDOT projects, including signage, cameras, upgrade to radio communications, etc. Of the $30 million, when I reviewed the numbers on it, approximately $3 million went to facility upgrades, and that was to upgrade the facilities within the existing DOT sites where the Minnesota State Patrol existed. And basically, it was a one-time purchase. Our radios were outdated. The rooms that we were in were very small. And in conjunction with an agreement with MnDOT to pick up their dispatching, MnDOT spent that $3 million to upgrade our systems that were up there. So while the term $30 million is thrown out a lot that to consolidate our systems, $30 million was not spent to consolidate the Minnesota State Patrol. Another point that I believe that Representative Cornish brought up was he's been told, or some of the members perhaps have been told, that we've lost a significant number of people because of the threat of PSAP consolidation. In fact, in 2010, we had 10 dispatchers leave for a variety of reasons, none of which had anything to do with PSAP consolidation. It was mentioned, the chair mentioned that there are a number of people that are concerned about this and have expressed it. Clearly, Representative Ward, Representative Cornish have constituents as well. Many of you have constituents as well. We have been in discussions with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Transportation, DOT, the Department of Transportation, at the commissioner's level, deputy commissioner's level, at their executive level, is in full agreement with the consolidation program that we're moving forward with. And then lastly, I guess I would touch on, and it wasn't talked about a lot here, but I think that it takes into play the chair's comments about situational awareness and about officer safety. As I mentioned previously, a number of states have moved to this. There have been no officer safety issues that have been associated with it. I've spoken with the Troopers Association, with a number of troopers, and while the troopers clearly do have concern for the dispatchers and their welfare and the idea that they may have to relocate, they've expressed no concerns directly to me about any concerns about officer safety with a consolidated PSAP. And so with that, sir, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Ward, let me ask just a few questions here, and then I'll get to you here. Just so that the patrol knows that some others are attendance here, I did meet with Colonel Donaski and the Commissioner Doman and advise them of my concerns and tried to convince them to drop the project. But once it was clear that it was going ahead, that's the only time that then I scheduled a bill for a hearing. Otherwise, I wouldn't if we could have come to some agreement. So I did respect and not just drop a bomb on them. Did you say 43,000, Colonel Donaski, in the overtime costs?
Mr. Chair, last year, $43,000, correct, sir.
Now, to me, that'll probably be surprise some citizens, but for me, that's a pittance in our state budget for what it's worth and to cover the overtime. And in the last year, since you had these people miss, and I don't doubt that we did have to plug the holes, the problem is Colonel, is that I can't find people that are for this. The MnDOT district engineer who said that in Mankato, for example, you had a brand new $15 million building we just bonded for. You had space. They were offering for the thing. You had ready to go. They didn't want to lose you, but you were going to consolidate anyway. The troopers, as far as I've talked to a number of troopers too, and I think there is concerns, but when a script is sent out telling the captains what to say and the dispatchers don't feel like they can talk about it, I don't know why anybody in the patrol would think that the troopers would speak out against this directly. So it's hard for us to get information with that kind of error going around. So I just have yet, when I go through this book and I find all the reasons, you know, that it should happen to the 10 centers and then completely switch directions in that short a time. And it closed with one of the people that was on the work study group that recommended this said that he felt that the committee didn't want to do this, but they were asked to come up what they thought. And then after a while, this trooper said it was pretty much known that this is the direction we want to go, find the excuses to get there. That was his feeling. So that's my frustration with the current system and where we're going and not finding enough reasons to go there. So, and then if you wanted to respond to that, otherwise I'd let Representative Ward ask.
Mayor, President, thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue, and I don't know if MnDOT is here. I spoke with the Deputy Commissioner last week and had hoped that MnDOT would have been here to testify. The issue of troopers and RCOs fearful of coming down here and then speaking out. Clearly, what you're telling me is that they feel free to talk with you in private, but not to come out in public. And I guess you've been in the system long enough to know that both the association, the Troopers Association, and the RCOs belong to rather strong and vocal unions. I don't know what form of retaliation myself or the management of the Minnesota State Patrol could possibly inflict upon either troopers or RCOs that felt that they wanted to make comments. As a matter of fact, a number of years ago, during a heated conversation with Essentiality, I was not the colonel at that time. RCOs felt free to come down at a time when there was controversy. So while I appreciate the fact that you have people talking to you, I don't really understand this concept that they feel a fear of coming forward and talking about it.
Colonel, after being a president of a union for three terms with the COs, I could list the number of ways that somebody could be harmed in surreptitious ways in their career if they took an adverse position, but there's all sorts of things that go on. But at any rate, hopefully that won't happen in the future, and by the time that the hearing gets to the Transportation Committee, we can have some more people come in and give some more testimony. But Representative Ward, did you want to comment?
And thank you, Mr. questions? Chair and members. And Colonel, I do want to comment on some of your comments. Number one, as I will concur with a lot of what Representative Cornish, Chair Cornish has said, is, you know, the $43,000 in overtime expense has fit our citizens in the state of Minnesota well. The 9 dispatching units has fit the citizens of Minnesota well. They have been served well. If you look at the consolidation and you look at the MAP members, you look at where those three proposed sites are going to be on, all on the eastern side of the state. You know, the western side of the state is of a concern to, I hope, all of us. I hope all of us are concerned about all parts of the state of Minnesota. Members, I also want to make sure that you understand when Colonel Donaski references other states. Understand that other states, you know, you can't look at apples to apples kind of thing, but the closest state that we can look at is Colorado. I'm glad you brought up Colorado. And because Colorado in itself is geographically about the same size, they have about the same amount of miles traveled, they have a mirror population, you know, so they have 5 regional centers. Correct, Colonel?
Correct.
5 regional centers. Not 3, not 2, not 1, 5. Because they understand the importance of a state our size, the citizenry of our, you know, of our population, the services that are provided to the state, citizens of the state of Minnesota need to be served regionally and geographically. So be careful when you hear about, okay, other states have done this. Make sure, because as we look at different states, Colorado is the one that definitely mirrors our situation. You know, having said that, Colonel and members and Chair, I suspect that eventually, if this happens, we'll be looking at adding a 4th unit or a 5th unit. And again, that is just poor planning, poor visionary focus. The other thing, Colonel, I wanted to make sure that this is clarified as well. You said that the TOCC project in 2001 did not, and if I'm misinterpreting what you said, please correct me, but you said that it didn't cost the State Patrol $30 million.
Colonel.
Let me just rephrase my question, Colonel. Was the TOCC project cost $30 million to the state of Minnesota?
Colonel.
I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
If you address the questions to us,
I'm sorry, Chair.
We'll ask.
I should know that. I'm sorry.
That way we don't end up in interrogation.
I'm a little bit fired up.
Get the lights
Mr. Chair,
and the rubber hose
Mr.
out.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm kind of coming off as Rick Covina here. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the question would be, Mr. Chair, to Colonel Donaski, regarding the TOCC consolidation in 2001, did that project cost $30 million to the state of Minnesota? That's what I want to know.
Colonel, can you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know what the exact cost was. The TOCC project did cost somewhere in the range of $30 million. That is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Colonel. Mr. Chair,
we've got
one more
couple other members that want questions.
One more point. And you brought up the point about the MnDOT not being supportive of this, Mr. Chair, as well. I've heard from them as well. But I also have heard from other law enforcement, besides patrol, but other law enforcement that do not think this is a solid plan as well. And, Mr. Chair, I want you to know, and I want members to know, that I have visited with Colonel Donosky a number of times on this, and at one point I suggested to Colonel Donosky, we have just put in a new communication training center at Camp Ripley with the highest technology going into that facility. And members, I want you to know that I talked to Colonel Donosky as a, suggesting that as well, that, you know, maybe we need to look at using Camp Ripley as one of the sites, as well as other sites around the state. So I just want to make that point, Mr. Chair, as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hilty, followed by Representative Grunhagen, and we've got a bunch of other bills yet today. Sorry about the length here, but Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, could you address the question of redundancy in the current system versus what would be in the proposed consolidation? And by redundancy, I mean sort of fail-safe backup provisions.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the question. It's a very good question. Right now, we have very little redundancy. We can transfer some of our telephone systems, but the communication system, the radio system, is not capable of doing that. The design for the three-center system is established in conjunction with DOT so that any one of our centers goes down, the other two centers are capable of picking up not only telephone and radio communication, but all the other sensor information that DOT is employing across the state. So if, for whatever reason it was, the metropolitan area went down, our TOCC in Roseville from a tornado or something, all of those services would be able to transfer it either to Rochester or Duluth.
And Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, what's the technology in which that's based?
I'm sorry, sir. Could you repeat that, please?
I asked what the technology is on which that is based. One concern that I have is that I think we have experienced in North America in the past sufficiently large solar impulses that have taken down communication systems and other electronic systems. We had a major blackout in North America, in Canada and the northern part of the United States due to one of those pulses in fairly recent history. And I'm just wondering if the system that we have or the system that you contemplate would be capable of dealing with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Go ahead.
Beyond my technological knowledge, most all the State Patrol, all the DOT, all the state services, and a significant number of the county and local agencies are going on to the 800 megahertz backbone, which the legislature has paid for over the past several years. I'm not certain what impact those type of issues would have on the 800 backbone, what redundancies they have in that specific system.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, do you believe this consolidation would compromise public safety?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely not. I am 100% certain that this is actually going to enhance public safety. And if I might, sir, we speak favorably about the TOCCs that are established and the personnel and the people that are there, very careful of it. We also must understand that it's a sole individual. Last week, you're probably aware that we had a high-speed chase in which five officers were involved in a shooting. During that high-speed chase, it came within a half mile of a tanker fire. So there's a tanker fire happening at the same time of a high-speed chase, and down in the southern part of the metropolitan area, there was another chase taking place. We have a TOCC in the metropolitan area that has a number of dispatchers that are able to adjust and shift and take care of those things. If that were to have happened in a greater Minnesota with one individual, let alone a citizen pull over and say that their child is choking, that sole individual has to prioritize and make a decision on who gets their services. By consolidating, we have a number of people, as we do in the RTMC, that are allowed to take peak issues like that. We have a number of issues happening simultaneously, handle all of them at one time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Colonel, if you implemented the consolidation and you came to the conclusion it was going to compromise public safety, due to a number of different factors that we don't completely understand right now, would you come back to the legislature and request modification or change?
Mr. Chair?
Colonel, go ahead.
Representative, frankly, sir, I've been working on this for 5 years. I've been the chief of the Minnesota State Patrol for six. this has been one of the most difficult projects that I've had to take on in my tenure. I firmly believe in it, but I also tell you that if I didn't believe in it, I would be the first one to come here and tell you that it wasn't going to work.
Just an final observation, Mr. Chair. You know, we had the one of the, my observation in government, we have these studies, whether federal or state, we have these studies, we spend years putting them together, we come up with recommendations, heads of departments get behind these recommendations to create efficiency and savings in some cases, and yet because representatives with constituents don't like the conclusion out of the studies, then we are resistant to implementing them. And that's the problem with a monopoly in government versus private business. And so I have a hard time not supporting the colonel's position. And I think it's been well thought through and documented. He's convinced of it. He's closer to the situation than what any of us are. And I think it's disappointing if we don't support his position. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen, the only question I have about that is that the DNR was famous for studies also, and I belong to them, and they took $250,000 out of our overtime account to do a study on Focus 2001. It should have been called a 2001 Space Odyssey because $250,000 was wasted and they never implemented any of the changes. So depends on the quality of the study, I guess. And Representative Ward.
Just one quick comment as well, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Representative Gruenhagen, I don't disagree with you, but I want you to understand that, you know, and those of you that sit on Health and Human Services, they have made many studies and many suggestions to the legislature, including community-based hospitals. And now they're back saying, you know what, they didn't work very well for us. They did not work very well for us. So, you know, I think we have to be careful when we as legislators, we as policymakers, don't question sometimes what is going on.
Okay, we're probably going to have to move along. As you know, we have Emily's Law today and another bill for the DNR that we have to get through. So any more comments or questions?
Just okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Just one quick comment, because the colonel made a statement about Gold Cross coming out of Duluth, and that is a bone of contention in my city, is because it goes through 911 dispatch, then to Rochester, then back to Duluth, and it's a waste of time. So consolidation is not always the best thing to do.
All right, members, if it's okay with you, we'll come to a vote. House File 977? The chair would move House File 977 be recommended to pass and move to the Transportation Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much, people, for your testimony, and thank you, Representative Ward, for presenting the bill.
Cornish, I understand House File 956. You move House File 956 and recommend it be sent passed and sent to the General Register?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 956 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register, but after moving that, I also have an oral amendment.
Okay, go ahead with your oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment of House File 956 would be after line or on line 2.16. And the staff can help me with this, Mr. Diebel. This section is effective July 1st, 2011. that the people that brought this forward want to change the effective date to July 1st, 2011.
And Mr. Diebel, would you like to make sure we have that in the right place?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, the effective date should follow line 2.16.
And Chair Cornish, that would actually change the date, correct, as well? Is that right?
Mr. Chair, yes, we want the date effective July 1st, 2011.
Okay. Mr. Diebel, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so the effective date would be July 1st, 2011, as opposed to the presumptive effective date of August 1st, 2011.
Any discussion on the oral amendment? Okay, all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the amendment's passed. To your bill, Chair Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill brought to me by the DNR, and rather than be redundant and introduce it and have him do it over again, I'll just turn it over to Major Smith, if you
Major
would.
Smith, can you give your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Major Rodman Smith, I'm the Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement. In front of you, House File 956 is two sections. Section 1 is the authority granted to the Department of Natural Resources Division of Enforcement to participate in the CYBRS program. Just a little history: when this program was first implemented, there was language that talked about a law enforcement agency under subsection C, like line 1.12, that defined law enforcement agency as municipal police departments, and then they talked about sheriff's departments and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and State Patrol. There are a handful of agencies that don't fit into those definitions, and over time, departments such as Metro Transit Police, Airports Commission, and the University of Minnesota Police Department have all had to come in and get included into the CYBRS program, and we're doing that as well since we do not fit into the original definition of law enforcement agency under a municipal police department or sheriff's police department. So we're asking for that authority to participate in the CYBRS program. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is supportive of us having the authority to join that program. Section 2 deals with silencers authorized for law enforcement and wildlife control purposes. And several years ago, the Department of Natural Resources under Sub B was given the authority to use silencers for disease control and wildlife control, and it had a sunset date of July 1st, 2011, and we're approaching that sunset date right now. And then further down under Part B, and when you get into lines 2.11 down to 2.16, it talks about limiting the number of silencers the Department of Natural Resources has to no more than 10. We'd like to remove that language. We feel that the trial date, I guess you could say, that was sunsetted here in 2011 shows that we've done a good job. And actually, just so you know, to give you an idea of how these are used, we don't currently own any. The Department of Natural Resources does not own any silencers. When we exercise our authorities to use silencers, we do that through contract with the federal government. And what we do is we hire a faction of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services, and under them is a group called Wildlife Services. And you may have heard in the news or read in the paper about the chronic wasting disease issue we had in the southeastern part of the state, and we had to depopulate that population by 900 deer to get samples. We started out by allowing landowners and give landowner permits to folks. They killed about 200 plus or minus deer, and then we had to step in and help reach our goal of 900, and we hired Wildlife Services, a federal agency, to go in and shoot the remainder of those deer, and Wildlife Services used silencers. We also use silencers up in the northeastern part of the state with the bovine tuberculosis issues we had up there for the last few years. To depopulate the deer herd up there, and we also contract Wildlife Services to depopulate cormorant populations, most specifically on Leech Lake. We work with the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in depopulating cormorants, and it's a very effective tool when you're trying to depopulate animals. And with that, I could stand for questions if there's any questions.
Members, do you have any questions? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, and I apologize up front because this is not my area, even remotely of expertise. But so I think I get the argument on why the need for a silencer relative to controlling populations. I think that's intuitively makes sense to me. Does the language before us, in terms of lifting that ban, does that apply to certain types of armaments that one would be using to control population, or would that apply to all weapons that firearms that the DNR? So I know you have a sidearm. Would we then be creating the opportunity for silencers for sidearms for the DNR officers?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these would be specifically for wildlife control and disease management, and they wouldn't really be an effective tool to use a handgun to depopulate a population. In fact, when we have injured deer on the side of the road, we don't use our handguns because they're not an effective tool to take down a big game animal, and you got to be pretty close. In practice, we wouldn't be using those, absolutely not. But I guess if you looked at the language, I guess possibly you could use a silencer then for a handgun, yes.
Mr. Chair and Officer, that makes sense to me. And even with my limited knowledge of the work that you do and firearms, and so perhaps for the Chair and the author of the bill, as the bill moves forward, perhaps, Representative Cornish, you might want to think about some language relative to firearms and, or rather, sidearms and silencers.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to DNR. Line 2.15, 2.16. The reason you're deleting that is because you entirely hire out to do the work. Is that what you said? That was your testimony.
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
No further questions. This being a public hearing, are there any members of the public who would like to testify in support of or in opposition to this bill? I guess he was not standing up for that. Okay. Chair Cornish, any other discussion regarding the bill?
No, if there is no comment, I'd like to restate my motion to move House File 956, recommended to pass, move to the General Register.
Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? House File 956 has been passed and will be referred to the General Register. House File 1428 is next.
Hang on just a second, Representative Wes McGregor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Representative Western, we're going to hear your House file today, 1428. And when we do it, would it be possible to just have your witness address the changes so we don't have to put her through the whole tragic circumstances again? Or
Mr. Chair, Ms. Johnson is here with me, and maybe I'll go through a few of the changes. She's got just a brief statement that she's prepared, probably about 2 minutes, and if that's okay, we'll be succinct on kind of the changes to the new bill and go from there if that works with you.
Okay, and then I'll move House File 14. Oh, Bud, I'm sorry, Representative Nornes is going to move the bill.
Yeah, I move House File 1428 and for passage and move to the Judiciary Committee. Is that correct? Okay.
Sounds good. Okay, the bill is in front of us. Representative Westrum, go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 1428 is a new draft of what you've heard as Emily's Law before. Not the same as the prior bill we had a hearing on, and let me just talk to you. The amended or modified language, we decided to put in a new bill. As you recall, the prior bill was asking to go down to age 10 for the option to certify as an adult, or EJJ, which is extended jurisdiction juvenile. EJJ is what we're talking about. This new bill doesn't do any adult certification, or doesn't give that as an option, and it moves the age of certification for EJJ from 10 up to 13. Current law is 14 for the option to petition or certify a juvenile as an adult or EJJ. This would reduce that age 14 down to 13 just for EJJ, not for an option to certify as an adult. Representative Moran, I know that was an issue we talked about last time, and others we have tried to reach out and talk to persons that had concerns with the prior bill and came back with what I would suggest is a very significant modification to that proposal. And so essentially what it does is reduces the age from 14 to 13 just for an EJJ, but it also modifies EJJ as we know it for this certain age group of juveniles. Under Section 4A, we allow EJJ, so you would have, first of all, a county prosecutor that would have to decide to use this tool. It would simply be a tool we would give them as an option in violent juvenile crimes, which are set out as basically if you kill somebody or criminal sexual conduct or malicious punishment of a child. Those are the only primary crimes that would be even classified to be EJJ at age 13. But the difference is EJJ, as you know, stays the adult sentence, and only if they don't follow through with their punishment as a juvenile or if they commit another crime in the future does that sentence become something they could invoke. The other significance thing that we worked out with some of the groups on was, and the concern I represent Moran, I don't remember particularly you had this concern as well, what about the state facilities for somebody who's a youth? This would not allow the Department of Corrections to be transferred the person who was under this EJJ a program at age 13. They would have to remain in a county jail facility and not be transferred to the State Department of Corrections if they ever had their adult sentence invoked. And so lastly, just a couple other things. By doing this, it would also allow a juvenile who's been in trouble and caused one of these violent crimes at age 13 to remain under a little more watch until age 21 instead of the current system, which would release them at age 19 when they turn age 19. Lastly, it would allow or have the courts and the BCA keep their records until 28 rather than expunging them earlier than that. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd let Ms. Johnson give a brief statement regarding the situation and then ask for other testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Westbrook. Ms. Johnson, would you like to testify?
Yes. My name is Lynn Johnson, and I am here on behalf of myself and my husband, who was unable to be here today. I would like to begin by thanking the committee for holding this hearing on House File 1428, also known as Emily's Law, and allowing us to testify today. On June 16, 2006, our lives changed forever. That morning, I dropped our two-year-old daughter, Emily Lynn Johnson, off at her daycare provider's house. Little did I know that would be the last time I would see my daughter smile. Less than 8 hours later, I received a call from the provider that when she went to wake Emily up from her nap, Emily wouldn't wake up and she had called 911. Once I got to the ER, I realized the situation was much more serious than I could ever imagine. The next day at 8:59 p.m., we held our daughter as they removed her off of life support and she took her last breath. In the days that followed, we learned that our daycare provider's 13-year-old son, who was just 19 days away from his 14th birthday, had gone into the room while Emily was napping, sexually assaulted her, and then violently threw her against a wall. Emily lay there for another 2 hours while her brain was deprived of oxygen, which caused irreversible brain damage. During the weeks that followed, the nightmare continued. We were informed that the young man who did this to our daughter could not be punished or held accountable for his actions. He was too young. Our state doesn't allow our prosecutors to make a decision based solely on the evidence and seriousness of the crime. As the law currently stands, a person must be at least 14 years of age to be even considered as an adult. What makes that a magical age? The person that assaulted our daughter and took her life, as stated earlier, was just 19 days short of this date. Why is our daughter lying in the ground while her killer is allowed to continue his life with minimal interruptions? Something must change so that no other family has to feel the injustice we have felt from our justice system. The prosecutor in our case has stated that if she had had the option, she would have strongly considered trying this person as an adult. My husband and I have been here, down here for the last 5 years trying to get the law changed so other families don't have to go through the same feelings of injustice in the future. Each year we have listened to the opposition and asked that we come to a compromise that satisfy all parties involved. Each year we were ignored or brushed aside. Finally, this year, with the help of Representative Westrom, Representative Nornes, John Reynolds, and John Tuma, we were able to agree upon the current language in front of you. My husband and I believe this language is a good compromise for both the victims of violent crimes and the juvenile system and opposition. I want to leave you with one thing. Please picture your 2-year-old daughter, your son, niece, nephew, grandson, or granddaughter. Now picture your loved one lying innocently taking a nap, peacefully in a room all by themselves. Now imagine what it would be like to not have that loved one to hug, kiss, or snuggle with. Because an individual made an intentional decision to go into that room and sexually assault her or him, and then violently assault him or her to the point that within hours, him or her brain was dead. Finally, imagine the feeling of injustice you and your family will feel for the rest of your lives because the individual who committed this heinous crime is free to live their life with little or no punishment. That, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is what my family goes through every single day. And that is why this law needs to be passed. My husband and I have always vowed that we will be back every year until the law is changed. And our commitment is stronger than ever. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. Representative Westman, who would you like to, out of your witnesses, do you have any more?
I don't have any more, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I've got want to be mindful here of your time.
I've got a list here. Janet Ryder from Chisago County Attorney.
Mr. Chair?
And if anybody coming up now, if sure appreciate if you could keep your comments short. We've got a number of witnesses here and instead of taking this past noon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Here. Before the testifier, I just wanted to call attention to the letter that's in your packet from the Assistant County Attorney in Otter Tail County, just for your reference as the testifiers come forward.
Thank you, Representative Norris. Ms. Ryder, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Janet Ryder, R-E-I-T-E-R. I'm the Chisago County Attorney, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee as well. I'm here to address House File 1428, and, you know, frankly, first and foremost, I want to extend my deepest sympathies to the Johnson family. Certainly, this was a tragic loss and a heinous crime and something that no family should have to endure. We recognize that. It is truly in times like these that we want to take steps to fix something. Certainly, something is wrong, and there needs to be steps taken to address a problem. However, it's our position that that this bill to lower the age for possible extended jurisdiction juvenile is really not practical, and it's really not warranted. Extended jurisdiction, or EJJ as it's commonly referred to, was controversial when it first was passed in 1995, and it was in response to a heightened or increase in violent juvenile crime. When we look at how extended jurisdiction juvenile is played out in our local jurisdictions, at the burden of our county prosecutors, with the burden on local public defenders and on our court systems, it is not simply at the discretion of a prosecutor. How this comes about is that EJJ can come into being through four different avenues, but for our younger offenders, currently for our 14 to our 17-year-olds, it is an option for the courts to decide after the prosecutor moves for certification as an adult and the judge decides that it's not appropriate for certification but will allow it to come into an EJJ process. Another one example for our 14 to 17-year-olds is when, at the court's discretion, a juvenile commits a felony, the court deems that the EJJ is simply appropriate. So how we see this playing out is that there are extended hearings where we litigate the issues surrounding an offense and surrounding the characteristics of the juvenile offender. It's extensive litigation. It can take days. It brings in resources from our schools and other programming resources. These are things that are not do not happen in a moment consideration by a prosecutor. Prosecutors are also keenly aware, and experientially they report that when crimes are committed by our youngest offenders, they are no doubt tightly woven with significant cognitive delays, developmental issues on behalf of the offender, emotional disturbances. These things are characteristics that we address with regard to our young juvenile offenders. Recently, in light of advancements in medical technology and our field of psychology, we know that the development of the juvenile brain is a slow, ongoing process. And when we're talking about young, undeveloped brains, we're looking at what is their level of culpability in committing, albeit the most heinous and horrific crimes. We need to look at their culpability in committing those offenses. So to lower the age for which EJJ is possible really brings in another pool of individuals, 13-year-olds specifically, that can be held accountable under the extended jurisdiction law. When we talk more broadly about that EJJ law, they are closely monitored. We tailor dispositions under the juvenile court system to meet the specific needs of individuals. They're not, for the most part, and I can't speak directly to the Johnson case, but for the most part, individuals are being treated. They are being monitored. They are being closely watched by both our mental health professionals and our court services professionals. So we do expend a tremendous amount of resources in all these juveniles, whether they are EJJ or simply under our jurisdiction of our juvenile court.
Ma'am, could you hurry it along? We've got about four other people.
Just in closing, from a public policy standpoint, the Juvenile Law Committee of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association feels that there are issues in creating, first, a new category of offenses, meaning the new violent juvenile offense, which is set out in this bill. And secondly, we anticipate that there are issues in simply carving out another category of a chronological age of a 13-year-old to face a different and significant or disparate treatment in our juvenile justice system. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Lieutenant Michael Sullivan, the Minneapolis Police Department. Anybody hear that name? Teresa Nelson, ACLU. Come on down.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Nelson, go ahead.
Members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're funded and supported by 8,500 members in the state of Minnesota, and our mission is to protect the constitutional rights of all Minnesotans under the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions. I do have written testimony that's much more extensive than what I'm going to say here in the interest of time. I'm not sure who I should give that to.
Page.
Okay. I think it's important at the outset for all of us to remember that our crime rate is dropping. The 2009 crime rate in Minnesota was the same crime rate that we had in 1968. All perceptions aside, that is the hard numbers that we have from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The ACLU of Minnesota opposes House File 1428 because it will result in violations of the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. It will widen the racial disparities that currently exist in our juvenile justice system. According to overwhelming research on juvenile crime, preventive measures are considerably more effective than punitive measures to address juvenile crime, and imposing adult criminal sentences on children actually decreases public safety. And finally, it runs counter to strong research showing that juveniles have the potential for rehabilitation and that children act more irrationally, impulsively, and immaturely, and are less able to comprehend the long-term consequences of their actions. First, House File 1428 will result in the imposition of cruel and unusual punishment. Reducing the age of eligibility for extended juvenile jurisdiction and criminal adult sentences constitutes cruel and unusual punishment because imposing adult punishments on children aged 13 is disproportionate to the child's culpability. The law treats children differently in every other field. Young people under the age of 18 may not use alcohol, serve on a jury, or be drafted because they are presumed to lack the capacity to handle these adult responsibilities. The state does not consider them legally responsible enough to live away from their parents, drive, make decisions about their schooling or their own medical care, vote, or sign a contract. These differences between children and adults are recognized through our laws and should be reflected in criminal penalties. As U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stevens noted, less culpability should attach to a crime committed by a juvenile than to a comparable crime committed by an adult. The basis for this conclusion is too obvious to require extended explanation. Inexperience, less education, and less intelligence make the teenager less able to evaluate the consequences of his or her conduct, while at the same time he or she is much more apt to be motivated by mere emotion or peer pressure than is an adult. Our awareness of the need to treat children differently has matured over the last few decades. In 1988, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to execute anyone who was 15 or younger at the time of the crime. The court noted that the reasons why juveniles are not trusted with the privileges and responsibilities of an adult also explain why their irresponsible conduct is not as morally reprehensible as that of an adult. In 2005, that ruling was extended to entirely forbid executions of juveniles who were under the age of 18 when they committed their crime. In some cases, the provisions of House File 1428 would allow 13-year-old children to be sentenced to life without the possibility of release, and that's for the mandatory sentence for premeditated first-degree murder is life without the possibility of release. This is a practice that violates not only the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment, but also several international treaties to which the United States is a signatory. House File 1428 will also exacerbate racial disparities in Minnesota's juvenile justice system. Minnesota Statute 260B.002 states that it is the policy of the state of Minnesota to identify and eliminate barriers to racial, ethnic, and gender fairness within the criminal justice, juvenile justice, corrections, and judicial systems in support of the fundamental principle that they're fair and equitable treatment under the law. There's already significant racial disparities in our juvenile justice system. And my written testimony has a bunch of pie charts that shows the racial disparities between juveniles and adults arrests in 2009. And while the racial disparities exist in both charts, the juvenile disparity is markedly higher. The disparities are even more stark with regard to juveniles who have been who have received adult sentences. According to the 2010 DOC statistics, less than half, only 38.5% of the juveniles committed to the DOC were white, even though white people make up nearly 90% of the state's population.
Ma'am, are you going to, that was going to be, you said, brief testimony, but are you reading the whole letter that you gave us?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not. I'm almost done. I've just got one more paragraph.
Sounds good. Thank you.
House File 1428 will not enhance public safety because it ignores research showing that preventive measures are more effective than punishment for juveniles. A study published by the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2007 found that transferring youth to the adult criminal justice system significantly increases crime. Instead of improving public safety, it produces the opposite effect. Research also indicates that preventive measures are considerably more effective than punitive measures, and that research is more fully set out in my written testimony. House File 1428 ignores the very real differences between children and adults and abandons the concepts of redemption and second chances upon which this country was built. Therefore, we urge the committee to vote no on House File 1428. Thank you.
Okay. Next, we have Joel Franklin, Jeff Martin, NAACP St. Paul Branch. Morning, sir. If you could state your name and title, and go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Joel Franklin. I'm the chair of the Legal Redress Committee of the St. Paul NAACP, and I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to speak. I'm here to voice the opposition from the St. Paul NAACP. And first, I'd just like to note, you know, my background. I'm a former prosecutor and former criminal defense attorney. And I don't think I've ever seen an issue where you had the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, probation officers, and the police agreeing on any single issue. And we all are opposing this bill. So please note that. That doesn't happen in criminal justice often. One of the main reasons that the St. Paul NAACP opposes this is due to the racial and ethnic disparities currently in our system. We feel that this bill will have a disparate impact on youth of color, especially black youth. In 2007, the three largest metro counties in Minnesota, Dakota County, Ramsey County, and Hennepin County, all reported that youth of color accounted for almost 100% of the transfers to adult courts. Minnesota has some of the worst levels of disparities in the country. According to the 2007 Minnesota State DMC Disproportionate Minority Contact Report, youth of color represented 62% of Minnesota's population in the juvenile detention center, while only 18% in the population. Black youth represented 7% of the Minnesota population and 40% of the youth in detention. And by contract, white youth represented 82% of the overall population and 38% of the youth in detention. The extent of racial and ethnic disparities in Minnesota juvenile justice system has reached a crisis level that must be addressed. What happened to the Johnson family was a tremendous tragedy, and as a father of three, I would not wish that type of pain on anyone. However, changing this law is not going to change or stop this type of crime from occurring in the future. And I can speak as a former prosecutor who's familiar with the Minnesota Supreme Court Race Bias Task Force. There are disparities in the criminal justice system from beginning to end. We don't know what happened with the juvenile involved in this particular case because we're not allowed to. He was a white youth, from my understanding. So there's no guarantee that he would have been prosecuted on the EJJ even if this law was changed. And due to the disparate impact that it will have on minority kids, we adamantly oppose this. In a civilized society, we have to hold our young people accountable for their action, but we also have to resist our national desire for punishment and focus on rehabilitation, intervention, and prevention. And given the dramatic rise in incarceration over the past decade, public safety is threatened unless the correction system does, in fact, correct rather than simply punish. Another thing I want to point out that I'm really concerned about is the expungement portion of this new amended bill. It states that a child who is adjudicated delinquent for committing a violent juvenile offense cannot expunge. It doesn't distinguish EJJ. So you know, you're talking about any type of offense, and I have a strong concern about that. I was just at a conference not that long ago where Judge Alexander, the president of the Council on Crime and Justice, was doing a presentation on the perpetual punishment in the state of Minnesota. And that's what we're doing when we are not allowing anyone to get back into society, and that's what this law would do. Currently, I work with children and who have committed offenses, and they're under the misconception that once they become 18 that their criminal record is clear, and that does not happen. If you didn't know that, that does not happen. We live in a computer society. Everything is in a computer database. Once a young person becomes an adult and they're applying for a job, they have to do a release, and that a release allows the employer to see everything, including juvenile records. So now we're setting up our young people to fail from beginning. Now you're talking about 11, 12-year-olds who committed crimes, who may have been victims of crimes. Because I deal with a lot of young people who were perpetrated on, and then they perpetrated on someone else, and now they were charged with a criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree. And now, due to something that happened when they were 10 or 11 years old, they're not going to be able to get a job and not going to be able to get housing. And then the cycle is just going to go on and on and on. A report from the Pew just came out that Minnesota has the highest recidivism rate in the country, 61%. And I can tell you personally from working with clients, defendants, you know, once a defendant, you know, wakes up, and I agree with the report, I understand that the brain doesn't develop until you're fully 25. I have many clients that didn't wake up until they're about 25 to 30, that going in and out of jail wasn't, you know, the way they wanted, you know, to live their lives anymore. And once they made that decision to change their lives, you know, we wouldn't allow them to get a decent job. We wouldn't allow them to get housing. So a lot of them, what they do is self-medicate with drugs and alcohol, which get them back in the system, or they commit crimes to support themselves and their families, and you got the revolving door. And that's what that 61% recidivism rate shows. So if we're going to set up kids that from 11, 12, 13 years old, that they cannot get a job, they cannot get housing, even colleges do background checks, we're setting up for failure, and we'll be back here again talking about the same issue because it's going to only get worse. Thank you.
Sir. Is there a Troy Parker? And members, I about the only editorializing I'll do, I would get accused of that once in a while, is that they said that rarely were people lined up against a law like this. Actually, there's been a number of times when people have been lined up against laws and they've still passed. One of them was a permit to carry. Every law enforcement agency and group you can imagine, almost the whole justice system was against the permit to carry, and it still passed. And after this many years, a very successful bill, and the sky didn't fall like they said it would. But, sir, go ahead with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cornish. First, I want to extend my sympathies to the family. But one issue that I have yet to hear anyone really address was, one, we're talking about parental involvement and oversight. And number two, we have to address the fact that this was a licensed daycare, I'm assuming, in the state of Minnesota. You know, I have two children as well. And whether I was watching someone for free or for a cost, I would not allow any children to be along with other children that long to commit these type of acts. So we have to look at what type of situation that would have been and deal more with the parents and the daycare, licensed daycare, that should have really taken some of these situations into account. We're trying to punish kids for the lack of parental oversight or for the lack of any type of guidance in their life. And I think that lowering this age to 13 would not necessarily rectify the problem. We have to deal with the real situations. I understand the Johnson family was extremely upset, but even Ms. Johnson and Mr. Johnson themselves stated to me that part of their frustration was the fact that the parents couldn't even be prosecuted or dealt with in this matter. So I think we really should deal with the matters and the issues at hand and look at this overall system and look at how things like this are being carried out and not just look for someone that's real easy and vulnerable to prosecute. I'm not saying that's the intent of this bill, but I'm saying we have to be real careful that we actually deal with the real issues. Thank you, sir.
Okay. We've gotten to the end of our testifiers here now, it looks like. Representative Westman, do you want to respond? Was somebody in the back raised your hand?
Oh, go ahead.
We'll give you two. Since you weren't on the sign-up sheet. Go ahead. I'll let you know when the 2 minutes is up.
Thank you very much. My name is Christopher Zahn. I'm an ex-convict. I spent 5 years in 5 Ohio and Minnesota prisons. Well, I saw dozens of men killed and assaulted in prison, and this is relevant, and I'll bring its relevance in one moment. In 1907, Carl Panzram, an 11-year-old Minnesota boy, was put in the boys' home in Red Wing, Minnesota. For the next 2 years, he was raped and sodomized repeatedly. Upon his release, he said, "I will kill everybody." He became the most prolific mass murderer in the history of this country. He killed more people than BTK, more people than Jeffrey Dahmer, more people than the Green River Killer. You can research him on the internet. There's plenty of information to support this story. It happened before national news, before the 24-hour news cycle. It was an 11-year-old boy whom the juvenile system inadequately equipped then to deal with the psychology of the brain of an 11-year-old, inadequately able to secure his safety in the Red Wing home, was turned into a monster. The impact on public safety is that 46 more people lost their lives in this country. That is my testimony, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Westrom, we only got 15 minutes left. We got another bill up.
Mr. Chair,
now we can move to questions.
People want to go to questions. I would have remarks, but maybe in the interest of time, let's go to questions and I can make a closing comment.
Somebody had their hand up over here. It was Representative Mariani and Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom, two quick questions. We probably won't have time to go into them in depth, but the gentleman from the NAACP, Mr. Franklin, highlighted an issue that, in addition to all the other issues, concerns me, which is this issue of expungement. And I can tell you in my community, my geographic community, this issue of expungement is having devastating effects on the ability of now grown and mature individuals to make a living. And so my question is, Representative Wester, why do you need this broad scope of expungement as it's crafted here, which isn't limited just to the AJJ, process. I'm thinking perhaps this was an oversight on your part, and so I want to offer you an opportunity to respond whether the language as crafted here with its broad application is indeed the language that you want to move forward with in this legislation.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, in general, the whole idea is a little more punishment that is going to alert other folks that might have a significant interest in knowing this information. If a person like this applies and to operate in a daycare or drive a school bus for your grandchildren or my children or somebody else's children, there's some benefit in knowing that. To the specific point of the broad application, I'm open to discussing that, and assuming this may pass and go to the Judiciary Committee, I would welcome that discussion. But the general sense is why not? Why should we hide this information from somebody that's committed a violent crime as a juvenile to future employers or people that might find themselves with the situation that they don't know about what is in that daycare or behind that school bus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, I'm somewhat encouraged by your response in terms of your willingness to look at what I understand to be an overly broad application of the expungement relative to the issue before us. But I am hearing two messages here, and I think your question is a great question, the why not question. And I think we began to hear from Mr. Franklin some of the outlines of the why not. And unfortunately, we're not going to have the time before us today to fully answer that question. And yet this is a key policy movement forward, and it should be answered before this bill moves forward. Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, if I can just very quickly ask you, relative to where this policy frame began, which began as an attempt to do adult certification, you've moved it now into the EJJ process. But nonetheless, the EJJ jurisdiction can result in the individual subsequently being remanded to an adult sentence, which actually in those situations would undo the changes that you brought forward. Is it still your desire to have these individuals ultimately adjudicated as adults?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, we have taken that out of the bill completely.
Well, Mr. Chair,
it is the EJJ process which for lack of a different name and maybe a better name for it, would be your second chance. Your second chance is really what an EJJ is. Okay, we aren't going to punish you harshly like an adult on this first crime at age 13 or 14 or 15 or 16 or 17, but you've got a second chance. That's really what it is, Representative
Mariani. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, I hear you, and I hear your intent here. But quite frankly, the information I get is that under certain circumstances having to do with the juvenile not complying with whatever's happening in the AJJ process, which I can imagine, you know, a young person with severe cognitive, emotional, mental state, which is the only state that I can think anyone committing at that young age this kind of a crime, I can see them probably pretty quickly not complying strictly. And in the EJJ process, they're going to wind up in the adult system. That's just the fact. And so if it is your intent to not have them in the adult system, but to have them in a very strict, severe, you know, guided EJJ system, then I think your legislation needs a little bit more work.
I've been having a conference up here with your co-author, and there's no way we can possibly finish today with the number of questions. I wonder if we could lay it over till the 26th and bring it up for a vote then and get the other bill here, as people drove quite a ways to testify, and we've only got 8 minutes left. And would it be okay with you if we laid the bill over temporarily and brought it up on the 26th when we come back from Easter break and vote on it then?
Well, Mr. Chair, certainly it's your committee, and whatever we can do to make it work. Ms. Johnson did have to drive a long ways down to today as well, and I understand the time constraints. So,
I don't think she'll have to be at the next hearing, actually, if we got all the testimony done now. So,
okay. And whatever works for you, Mr. Chair, and I think that still allows us to meet the April 29th deadline.
You bet. Okay, members, we'll lay this bill over temporarily to be brought up later. Thank you, Representative Westrum. And Representative Drazkowski, House File 522. What's the number? Representative Drazkowski, in the order of time here, I'll move your bill, House File 522, to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion to an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 522, members, is a bill that is really arising out of the need that has been identified multiple times in southeast Minnesota to find ways to develop flexibility for counties around our whole county jail situation. Members, there's a consortium of 12 counties in southeast Minnesota, and there's a publication going around the pages are handing out. That has been meeting to talk about the situation with their jails. The majority, I think probably all but the two of them or something like that out of the 12, have substantially lower jail population than they do space. And so what we're running into is really, and I know we've seen this throughout the state, an overbuilt situation. And we're looking forward to finding ways to make those facilities work together better, bring the counties to work together better. But I'll turn it over, Mr. Chair, if I could, to one of our county commissioners, Mr. Harms from Wabasha County.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And, sir, go ahead and state your name and title and begin.
David Harms, Wabasha County Commissioner. Chairman Cornish, thank you for your time. I'm just going to address one specific area of some of the problems that we are encountering down there with a brand-new 82-bed jail, and that is that we're licensed currently because of the population needs for half the number of prisoners that we could accommodate. Of the 40 beds that we're licensed for, we have to keep some vacancies for immediate needs for our law enforcement in the area. But we have to staff at a certain level. The one thing that I would ask for is, out of this amongst many, but I'll only address this one today, is that we need some consideration on the other end of the spectrum, where if we have to keep beds vacant, if we should happen to go over population for a short period of time, not for a long period of time, but for 10 days or 20 days, that we not have to increase staff to meet the state's current requirements. I guess if you understand, everybody understands that once you hire the staff, it's very difficult if the population should drop again to make changes down the other way. So we would ask that as a consideration, and we do understand that there is some work with the Department of Corrections to make some changes in the mandates that we're currently burdened with. And just closing, we're a rural county of 22,000 population. It has remained stable over the last census period, essentially, I think about a 60 population difference. So with a $26 million bonded jail, our taxpayers are quite heavily burdened. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir. Another person to testify, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In addition to Commissioner Herms, we have Commissioner Seifert here from Goodhue County.
Hey, Commissioner, if you could state your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ted Seifert. I'm a Goodhue County Commissioner. I've been so for 8 years. I currently serve at the pleasure of my colleagues as chairman of the board. 10 years ago, Goodhue County built a 170-bed jail. They were told to do that because they could expand for population and they could generate a revenue stream by boarding prisoners. 3 years ago, we averaged probably over 100 all the time and collected $1 million in that revenue stream. This year, the first quarter of this year, we've averaged 54 Goodhue County prisoners. We have boarded no prisoners whatsoever. The environment out there has changed. The Commissioner of Corrections has stated that the state has done a very good job in with the community corrections. We've reduced our sentencing and so on, and so there's just not a stream of prisoners out there. So while we're required to staff as if we were going to fill all 170 beds, we only have 50, and we're just looking for some ability for the sheriff to determine what makes a reasonable staffing scenario. Every one of those jails in 11 counties in southeast Minnesota have different architecture to them. So one shoe fits all, as the 2911 rules would require, doesn't work very well. Our current jail budget for this year is $4 million. Our sheriff gave us some scenarios that said we could save $1 million if we could staff differently.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Draskowski, their comments, and we can take questions now if you'd like. We got two of them to go, unless you want to.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franklin's here too, from the Sheriff's Association. But as I mentioned, many of these jails are underpopulated. The economics of those situations are not good, and we're looking to find ways to bring more flexibility for these counties to operate. As they look at it, as you can see through the materials that I've distributed, they look at ways to work together and bring innovation about the jail population in southeast Minnesota. And the intent, Mr. Chairman, of the bill is to bring role of the Department of Corrections as it relates to counties to more of an advisory role rather than a regulatory one. Right across the border in Wisconsin, we're told that that's what they have over there. It seems to be working fairly well. I've had some discussions with Mr. Franklin and Mr. Erdman from AMC, and I know that they are working with the Department of Corrections right now to look at rewrites of this section, the 2911 rules, and I don't know if you want to hear from Mr. Franklin too, but I am encouraged in that they are suggesting that there may be the possibility as we go ahead, and they're hopeful. The Department of the Corrections Commissioner seems to be very open to the notion of looking at rewriting these rules in a way that does actually serve more of an advisory capacity, one maybe that would be a set of model rules, at least I'm hopeful, a set of model rules that the counties could follow that would still provide for that uniformity without the regulatory handcuffs, if you will, no pun intended, Mr. Chair, that these rules are placing upon these counties.
Representative Gauthier and Johnson, Mr. Franklin, Director, would you like to say something? We only got about a few minutes left and two questions from our members.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. I'll be very, very brief. The 2911 standards were written a number of years ago. They obviously need to be revised. We started that process over 2 years ago and have been working on it in consultation with the jail administrators, the county commissioners. AMC has been a partner here. And we're nearly completed. We do have several areas. This happens to be one of those that is yet to be resolved. So I believe with a little more time, we suggested holding this bill over and let us work on it. We believe in a little more time yet this year and in this next legislative cycle, we will have these completed. We will address some of the issues that are right already addressed. There is another portion of the 2911-0400 that does allow for counties to use variances and ask for variances. I don't think that has been used and utilized sufficiently. There are some prohibitors there that we want to look at, but we do believe that there's some ways of working collaboratively to work these issues out. We are sensitive to these concerns, and they are true concerns that we need to address.
Okay. We've got Representative Gauthier and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question for Representative Draskowski. If we were to move these out of the Department of Corrections, as your bill calls for sheriffs, would the sheriff's department be able to determine or schedule, say, nursing staff in addition to just jailers?
Mr. Chair? I would expect, Mr. Chair and Representative Gauthier, that maybe Mr. Franklin could answer that better than I, but I do know that or have been told that should the bill be enacted into law the way it is, that the Sheriff's Association in that case would be in a position to have to develop some sort of standard for its membership to work with to begin with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we would need to put something together. Otherwise, we're going to have 87 independent decisions being made. While we recognize that each one is a little bit different, there needs to be some sort of standardization, and we would work diligently to try to do that. We think collaboration with the DOC, with the 2911 rules, makes some sense.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Well, my concern would be, in an effort of cost-saving, moving towards passing meds, having jailers do that, and not necessarily being trained in what to do with overdoses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as a nurse would do. That would be my only concern, so I would support some standardization about medical staff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have a division of nurses under the Sheriff's Association already formed. They already have protocols written. We work together with the DOC and the 2911 standards on the passage of meds, all of those kinds of things that you're referring to. Again, this is a collaboration partnership effort that we have to work on together jointly.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Franklin's answered most of my concerns, but just to emphasize, I do think we clearly need universal standards and best practices met uniformly throughout the state. There's a reason for those standards being in place. We need to see that they're working collaboratively towards some end in that regard. That's fabulous. I understand the need for some flexibility. That makes sense. But we do need to have the standards in place that are uniform throughout the state.
Mr. Chairman,
Briefly. We're going
to
take off.
Just to that point, times have changed when the standards were written 10, 15 years ago to where we are today. The roller coaster of what we have today to deal with, we need a little more flexibility in those to adjust to our business model practice.
Thank you, Representative Draskowski. We'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, unless you had something to close with.
Just thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right, thank you. And members, I just want to...
Mr. Not a question, just a real quick point. I agree with Mr. Franklin. We need some kind of standards, and nobody's mentioned the fact that the courts step in if we don't have something like that.
Okay. The bill is laid over for possible inclusion. And members, I just want to make the announcement here that the time for public testimony in Emily's Law is closed. When we bring it up again, there will be no public testimony allowed, and we will go to a discussion with members and a vote. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.